as best as I recall, I was going to make an argument to the effect that the data that we've been collecting so far, or the data that researchers collect using the kind of methods that we talked about this morning, is extensional data, meaning it's data that illustrates usages of linguistic expressions in reference to a particular entities or states of affairs. But at best, that gives us information about the referential content of the expressions that we've been recording, collecting. But it doesn't yet give us information about the underlying meaning in the sense of the conceptual representations in the mind of the speaker that these expressions map into and that interpret them cognitively. And the argument I wanted to make is that in order to get there, in order to get at the actual semantics, the sense, rather than the mere extension, we need more than positive evidence, we need negative evidence. So we're going to start out with a distinction between positive and negative evidence, and that has to do with the fact that the goal of linguistic description is to produce a record of the competence of the speakers. The competence that enables the knowledge, the procedural knowledge that allows a competent speaker to be just that, a competent speaker of the language. And that means we have to have some representation, not just of what the speaker actually does in the context in which we study them, or what the speaker did when we observed them. For example, during the elicitation sessions, such as those that we talked about this morning, but we actually need a sense of what the speaker can do and what the speaker cannot do, or what the speaker won't do. And that requires negative evidence. So, in a sense, what we're engaged in when we're trying to study language in the field, when we're trying to produce a record of the language, a language description, is a transformation of the observable procedural knowledge of the speakers, or rather the products of that procedural knowledge, into declarative knowledge of us as scientists, as linguists, as researchers who study these languages. And that, I believe, uncovering the underlying knowledge of the speaker, even if the knowledge itself is procedural, if we want to make declarative statements about it, we'll need negative evidence. And the reason I'm emphasizing the role of declarative knowledge, the fact that the language description itself is declarative knowledge, and let me back up here for a second and try to be a little more explicit about this. So you know that the speaker. Any speaker of any competent speaker of any language is going to be able to use the grammar of that language without actually being able to explain to you why they do what they're doing. Otherwise, we would all be unemployed. There would be no job for us as linguists, because if the native speakers could explain themselves what they're doing, then, you know, that's it. They could just produce the description themselves. So the difference between what the speaker actually does and our record, our account of the underlying cognitive processes. That's precisely the difference between procedural and declarative knowledge. Because the knowledge the speaker has of the grammar and lexicon and the practices of use of their language is just procedural knowledge. It's knowledge of how to do things, not knowledge of facts that you can state verbally, such as verbal generalizations, the kind of generalizations that language descriptions consist of. And that's where I argue we need negative evidence. And that constitutes an important difference between language description and language learning by children. Because this morning and yesterday I argued that fundamentally, as field researchers studying the semantic system of the language, we're not in a different position from that of the child learning the semantic system of their native language. Except there is a difference when it comes to describing this semantic system, because that's something the child doesn't have to do. So the child presumably is going to be able to learn all the procedural knowledge that's required to speak the language on the basis of positive evidence alone, whereas the researcher is not going to be able to describe the language on the basis of positive evidence alone. Why am I saying that? There's been a long-standing debate going on for many decades in language acquisition research or child language research on the role of negative evidence. Generally, most people in the field assume that children don't have a whole lot of negative evidence available, and obviously they're still able to learn the language they're growing up was just fine. What do I mean by negative evidence in this case? Basically, suppose the child makes a wrong generalization. Remember that U-shaped learning curve that we talked about yesterday. The child has figured out that there is a productive category here, but hasn't quite zeroed in on the appropriate rule. The category the child is hypothesizing is underlying the adult's uses is actually too broad, so the child overgeneralizes. The problem is, it's not typically the case that every time the child does that, there is some competent speaker at hand who will correct the child. That's what I mean by negative evidence in this case, right? The child uses the word dog not just for dogs, but also for lambs and cows and cats and what have you. It's not the case that every time that happens, there is an adult around who's going to tell them, no, actually, that's not a dog. That's a cow. Big animal. Gives milk, moos. Dog, small animal. Barks, bites, furry, etc., etc. No, that's not a distinguishing feature. Never mind. Oftentimes the child does have negative evidence, but apparently she's going to be able to get by even without a whole lot of negative evidence. That's a fundamental. How exactly that works is a big mystery, and a lot of ink has been spilled, a lot of research has been devoted to this question, but it's not the case that a definitive answer has been found. However, this constitutes a fundamental difference between semantic research and language description on the one hand and child language acquisition on the other hand, because for us, in order to come up with the generalizations, the declarative generalizations about what the native speakers are doing, we do need negative evidence. I'm defining positive evidence as suggesting that a given hypothesis is likely correct, and negative evidence as evidence suggesting that a given hypothesis is likely incorrect. But in practice, the way people have been using these terms, positive and negative evidence, not just in child language research, but in science in general, are much more complex and muddied. Most commonly, the term positive evidence is used for empirical support of a proposition of the form, there is an X such that P. So this is a proposition that you can verify by observing a single instance of an X that is P. As soon as you found one example, you know that this proposition is true. That's what people typically talk about when they're talking about positive evidence. On the other hand, negative evidence, that's what people mean when they're talking about verifying a proposition such as there's no X such that P of X, there's no X that is P. The verification of this one is a lot harder because you need to inspect every possible value of this variable X to see whether there isn't one that is P. So these are existentially quantified statements for those of you who have a background in logic. What about universally quantified statements for all X, P of X, all X are P, let's say all verbs of a given type in this language have a certain feature, something like that. Those are closely related to negative existential statements because for every statement of this kind, there is an equivalent statement, there is no X that is not P of X. So, for both negative existentially quantified statements and for universally quantified statements, it's the case that there is a large, possibly indefinite or infinite domain of cases that would need to be inspected in order to strictly verify that this proposition is true. In other words, you need a lot more evidence to verify this one than you need to verify this one. And that's fundamentally, epistemologically, the problem of negative evidence. I already talked about this. Once again, in language acquisition research, it seems to be generally possible for the child to get by on the basis of positive evidence alone. However they do it, it's an amazing feat to be sure. In language description, generally we're interested in universally quantified statements, or at least implicitly universally quantified statements. So we're interested not just in stating individual observations of events, we're interested in statements, generalizations about what the speakers of this language do in general, what all speakers do whenever they encounter a particular condition, or we're interested in generalizations over all tokens of a particular type of a lexical category, a given verb or noun or what have you, and so on and so forth. So, in other words, one way or another, the bulk of the statements that a language description consists of are implicitly or explicitly universally quantified or negative existential, which means they require negative evidence. All right. I mean, that's curious. Semantic properties that can only be attested at the sense level, not extensionally. All right. So I understand the first one. I don't understand the second one because I would assume that these are the same thing. Anyhow, I mean, I wrote this 2 weeks ago, but I don't remember why I wrote it. I'm sorry. I'm unprepared. So, basically, when we're trying to get from extensional data to the underlying senses, the conceptual representations in the mind of the speaker, we have to filter out pragmatic meaning components from semantic meaning components. In other words, we have to distinguish between pragmatic and semantic meaning components. And we're going to see that that in particular requires negative evidence. And that's what I'm going to be talking about for most of this lecture. And that then will lead us to those semantic properties that pertain to the sense level, and not just to the extension, the set of possible reference. All right. So now I'm gonna take a step back, and I'm gonna talk briefly about the relationship between semantic and pragmatic meanings. So this is background. Here you have a classification of different types of meaning. Traditionally, people have been distinguishing between word meaning, sentence meaning, and utterance meaning. More precisely, word meaning is lexical meaning. Sentence meaning is compositional meaning, so that's not necessarily just sentence meaning, but it may be the meaning of phrases. In principle, it's the meaning of any complex expressions that are licensed by the morphosyntax, the grammar of the language. But then, of course, on a constructionist view, the grammar of the language consists of constructions, and there's no fundamental difference between constructions and lexical items. So another way of talking about this contrast is in terms of that between lexical items that have a particular phonological string associated with them, and lexical items that are more abstract patterns or templates of combining words into larger expressions, aka constructions. And utterance meaning is, more precisely speaking, pragmatic meaning. It's meaning that occurs at the speech act level, but what exactly that means, we have to take a closer look at. And whereas lexical meaning and compositional meaning are studied by the field of semantics, or in the field of semantics, pragmatic meaning is studied, well, in pragmatics. The fundamental difference here is between linguistic expressions and utterances. So words and sentences are linguistic signs, which means they are abstract units of linguistic code, symbolic units of which the speaker has some knowledge of, and which you may think of as actually abstractions over the actual verbal behavior of the speakers. But then they would be abstractions that also occur as abstractions in the speaker's mind as objects of the speaker's procedural knowledge. But you can think, in principle, of these things as entities in some sort of abstract Platonic space of ideas. Or you don't, depending on your philosophical inclinations. But whatever they are, they're different from utterances. Utterances are actions. Utterances are things that speakers do. Utterances are things that happen at a particular moment in time, in a particular place in the world. Whereas, words and phrases and sentences are not things that have a place or time associated with them. In that sense, they're abstract. Utterances are particulars. Words and sentences are abstract objects. Okay, let's take a quick look at some examples. This is the example that I give the students in my semantics classes as an introductory example. So it's a pretty contrived example. Stunned professors and students saw the fruit bed escape through the classroom window. This example is so weird and complex because I made it up such that I could illustrate a whole lot of different problems with respect to it. So a lexical semanticist might want to say that stun is a polysemous verb which includes a concrete sense that has something to do with dulling the senses of a sentient being or something like that, and then it has a metaphorical, a transferred sense that talks about surprise. A lexical semanticist may be interested in the semantic roles that the verb see entails, such as the experiencer and the stimulus role. A lexical semanticist may be interested in the compounds fruit bed and classroom window. Fruit bed has a taxonomic structure that names the a subordinate species of the species lexicalized by the head, which is bat, so that makes this a determinative compound. Classroom window, on the other hand, has a part-whole structure where the head refers to a part of the classroom. All right, a compositional or formal semanticist, somebody studying sentence meaning, might want to talk about the reference of the noun phrases professors and students. Both of these are bare plurals, and since they are bare plurals made from count nouns, they refer to a number of individuals greater than one. The fruit bed and the classroom refer to exactly one individual. The verb phrase saw the fruit bed denotes a single event which happened in the past of the other time, as indicated by the past tense inflection. Gerund escaping refers to a single event which was because of the morphological form here was contemporaneous with the observation, the seeing event. and so on and so forth. It goes on and on. There is an entailment here that the fruit bed was visible to the professors and students. And most interestingly, the sentence has several syntactic ambiguities. So, for example, under one reading, both the professors and the students were stunned. Under one reading, it was only the professors who were stunned, but not the students. Also, what the professors and the students observed may have been the escaping of the fruit bed through the classroom window, but it's also possible that what the professors and the students observed was the escaping event, but it may have been the professors and the students' observation that proceeded through the classroom window. And all of these different interpretations are associated with different syntactic parses of this string. So finally, what about pragmatics? This is where it gets interesting for our purposes, because remember, where we're headed is trying to weed out or trying to sort out semantic from pragmatic meaning components. A pragmaticist may want to say that the utterance presupposes that there were students, professors, and a fruit bed, and a classroom window, and so on and so forth. All the definite descriptions in this sentence carry existential presuppositions. And of course, how do you know that these are presuppositions? We talked about that a little bit yesterday. They're presuppositions because if you negate the sentence, or you turn it into a polar question, or you turn it into the antecedents of a conditional, these implications remain intact, right? So these are all assumptions that we need to make in order to make sense of the sentence, whether or not, or regardless of the speech act in which it is used. So by virtue of that, these meaning components are presuppositions. Alright, so then come the conversational implicatures, and that's really the bulk of what we're concerned with when we're trying to get at the underlying sense, when we're trying to isolate the sense in the extension, in the extensional data that we've collected. So what are conversational implicatures? These are inferences that aim at getting the most information out of the utterance. So the addressee, the hearer, will infer more than the speaker actually says, and the speaker will be able to rely on some of these inferences. The speaker will be able to predict and rely on the hearer deriving some of these inferences, and therefore the speaker may leave a great deal of the intended information that they're trying to get across to these inferences. And on the other hand, the speaker may also anticipate unwanted inferences and therefore change the utterance in order to prevent these unwanted inferences, such that if the utterance is finally produced in a given form, the addressee or hearer is invited to assume implicitly that all the inferences that are still triggered by the utterance, inferences that are easily predictable for both the speaker and the addressee, that all of these are in fact intended by the speaker. For example, the inference that the professors and the students were inside the classroom rather than watching from the outside, or that the bat was flying rather than walking, or that the bat escaped exiting this classroom rather than flying in. All of these are... Or for example, that the window was open rather than the bat crashing through it. All of these are stereotype inferences. They're inferences to the effect that there is one particular interpretation here that is much more prominent than the others based on world knowledge. And this in turn depends on the cultural background of speaker and hearer. And the hearer is generally invited and licensed to assume that all those stereotype inferences go through, because it's incumbent upon the speaker to prevent stereotype implicatures that don't apply. So this is described in the framework of implicature theory that was developed by H.P. Grice, and first published in the mid-1970s. And finally, there's the speech act level. So the speaker, in this case, makes an assertion, which means that the speaker commits themselves to the truth of the report they deliver, and that in turn has certain felicity conditions. For example, we are entitled to assume that the speaker is sincere and that they actually themselves believe in what they're saying. So you could say Well, let's pick a simpler example. You could say, well, it's hot today, but actually I don't believe that it's hot today. That's not logically contradictory. It's perfectly fine to say that, except pragmatically it's infelicitous, because when you're saying it's hot today, you're thereby committing yourself to the truth of this utterance. And if you don't actually believe it, rather, if you say that you don't believe it in the very next utterance, then that commitment becomes pragmatically infelicitous, and so the hearer is at a loss as to what's the point you're actually trying to make. Okay, so those are three out of four traditional meaning components, or three out of four meaning components that are traditionally ascribed to pragmatics rather than semantics: speech, acts, conversational implicatures, presuppositions. The fourth one is indexical or deictic meanings, meanings that are context-dependent, such that the lexical form of a word actually taps into the non-linguistic context and retrieves a referent, or instructs the speaker and the hearer to retrieve a referent from the non-linguistic context. I'm talking about expressions such as this and that, I and you, now, then, today, tomorrow, and so on and so forth. All of these are indexical or deictic expressions that retrieve components of the speech situation. So that, too, is a type of meaning that's traditionally studied in the field of pragmatics. And you can see, I hope, to some extent, how all of these different meaning components crucially go beyond the word and sentence level and depend on the actual utterance. In some sense, we could say that all of these are context-dependent in a broad sense. And that fundamentally, since the context is a property of the utterance rather than the abstract sign, the abstract semiotic unit, the sentence or the word, the phrase, etc., words, phrases, etc., since they don't have a place in time and space, they have no context. But utterances, even if they consist of a single word, utterances always have a context. Therefore, all of these meaning components occur at the pragmatic level, at the utterance level, and not at the semiotic, at the sign level, at the level of the abstract sign. Okay, and then expressives would be a fifth component that have recently been attracting a lot of attention again. And so this includes stuff such as "my damn computer is on the fritz again," where this conveys an attitude of the speaker that does not contribute to the conditions that make this utterance true or false. The same goes for honorifics. I have a German example here. "Du bist dran," it has the solidarity form of the second person pronoun, which is used for people who are your social equal and who you're familiar with. "Sie sind dran" means exactly the same thing. Both translate as "it's your turn" in English, but this one uses the polite form of the pronoun, which is used for people who are socially superior and or are not solidaries, meaning you're not familiar with them. Of course, Languages such as Mandarin have much more complex honorific systems than this. But even in Europe, this stuff is widespread. And the English type, where you have no honorific distinctions in pronouns, is an exception. So some people consider these kinds of expressions a fifth dimension of pragmatic expressions. All right. Now I'm going to argue. Right. So implicatures and presuppositions are pragmatic meaning components in the sense that they're context dependent, whereas entailments are semantic meaning components in the sense that they occur independently of context whenever an expression is used. And in a strict sense, it's only sentences that have entailments. Lexical items and phrases, the constituents of sentences, contribute to these entailments but don't have entailments themselves. So, in the sense that entailments are, or in the sense that implicatures and presuppositions are context dependent, whereas entailments are not, what we have to do when we're trying to get from extensions to senses is we have to distinguish between entailments and those pragmatic meaning components, implicatures and presuppositions. So these are here are some definitions. Entailments are relations between propositions. One proposition entails another proposition if there is no possible situation in which the first is true but the second is not. Implicatures, conversational implicatures, are a proposition conversationally implicates another proposition if and only if the assertion of the first proposition suggests the second in an appropriate context, but doesn't actually entail it. And we then say that the second proposition is a defeasible inference from the assertion of the first. The metaphor Steve Levinson used, well, it's not just a metaphor, it's a computational metaphor, if you will. Implicatures, conversational implicatures, are default interpretations. In particular, Grice distinguished between two types of conversational implicatures, generalized and particularized implicatures. It's above all the generalized ones that are default interpretations. The particularized ones are default interpretations in particular contexts, but they always depend on the assumptions about the speaker's communicative intention. So the famous textbook example, somebody says, "It's cold in here, and maybe they're trying to get the hearer to close the window or something like that." But that would actually go through only as given an assumption about the current state of affairs, the non-linguistic context, and the speaker's intentions and maybe their attitude towards the hearer, and so on and so forth. So this inference, I'm going to use this sign combination of a plus sign and a closing chevron for implicature. This inference does not depend on on the form of this utterance or the type of utterance that it is. It does not in any way depend on the signs, the structure of the sentence, the words that occur in it. It's just a function of the contents of the utterance. That's what Grice calls particularized conversational implicature. On the in contrast, if you say something like, " I'll, you know. Floyd ate some of the cookies. That implicates Floyd didn't eat all of the cookies. This is also an implicature, just as in this case, it doesn't need to be true that the speaker wants the addressee to close the window. In this case, it doesn't need to be true that Floyd ate only some of the cookies, that he didn't eat all of the cookies. But this does not just depend on the concrete context of this particular utterance. It's actually something that derives from the word some that's used in here. So it depends on the linguistic expressions that are used in the utterance, and in that sense it's a generalized conversational implicature. And those things in particular are what Levinson calls default interpretations, because they are not, strictly speaking, they're context dependent in the sense that the context can cancel or block them, but in the absence of such blockage, they will always arise on the basis of a particular trigger, a particular lexical expression, or a particular syntactic construction that invites this inference. In that sense, they are default interpretation. And that's in particular what we need to try to identify in the extensional data that we've collected. Okay, and then finally there's the property of projection, which is the property of presuppositions, although there is a larger class of semantic inferences that have this property. A proposition projects another proposition if and only if any speech act involving the first suggests the second, but the first doesn't entail the second. So the crucial difference between this definition and the preceding one is the formulation any speech act involving the proposition, whereas conversational implicatures only arise under assertion. So this is the property that we've seen before. If I say Floyd or Sally chased the squirrel out of her yard, that presupposes that there was a squirrel in her yard. If I say Sally didn't chase the squirrel out of her yard, it still presupposes that there was a squirrel in her yard. If I say, did Sally finally chase the squirrel from her yard, it still suggests that there was a squirrel, and so on and so forth. The independency of the speech act that's built around the particular proposition, that's what sets apart projection, and that's what identifies this property of presupposition. So here's a classification of inferences, linguistic inferences, entailments, implicatures, and presuppositions. Entailments are not defeasible and they're not projected. Implicatures are defeasible, but they are not projected. They only occur with assertions. And presuppositions are also defeasible, although when they are defeated, a truth value gap arises. So if you say Sally chased the squirrel from her yard and it turns out there never was a squirrel from her yard, there are philosophical reasons. I mean, you know, our first intuitive response will be to say, well, okay, so the assertion, the claim was false. But actually it's a little more complicated than that, precisely for the reason that in that situation, the negation Sally didn't chase the squirrel from her yard would also be false. But it's not possible for a proposition and its negation both to be false. One of them has to be true. So therefore, strictly speaking, the result here is something that's uninterpretable. We cannot say it's true, we cannot say it's false, it's uninterpretable. But what sets presuppositions apart from the other is that they're projected, so they are independent of the speech act. Okay, so how do you test for entailments? And of course, this is tricky stuff, because strictly speaking, the way entailment is defined, right, a proposition entails another if and only if the set of situations or possible worlds or context, whatever you want to call it, in which the first is true is a subset of the set in which the second is true. Well, that would mean you have to inspect a very large, possibly indefinite or infinite set of possible situations in which this kind of proposition could be used, which is an impossible task. And that gets us back to the problem of negative evidence. So, in practice, what do you do? One way you can go about this is you ask the speaker, can you imagine any situation in which the first proposition is true but the second is not? So, for example, you want to know whether the fruit bat escaped from the lab through the window entails the fruit bat flew out of the window. And of course, we already know that that's not an entailment. We know that that's a stereotype implicature, because the prototypical manner of motion for a bat is flying. So therefore, this is, you know, in the absence of further information, the most likely assumption the speaker will make, the hearer will make. But it's not an implicature. So we ask the speaker, all right, supposing a situation in which somebody says this thing, can you imagine that to be true even though it's not the case that the bat flew out of the window? And this is, again, the kind of task for which you will need an informant, a consultant with some imagination, because they have to think about this and they have to have the ability to extract themselves from the concrete situation and imagine something quite unreal that could be the case. And, you know, like I said before, that's not everybody's pot of tea, cup of tea, whatever. Another way to go is to give the speaker the proposition that triggers the putative entailment and the negation of the putative entailment, and see whether the result is a contradiction for the speaker or not. So you tell them, okay, tell me whether the following sentence is possible or whether it's a contradiction. The fruit bat escaped from the lab through the window, but it did not fly. And presumably, the speaker will tell you, yep, that's fine. I can't imagine a situation in which that is the case, in which the bat actually climbed up the window and hopped out. Okay, fine. So that's how you prove that it's not an entailment. So you've defeated an implicature. You've identified an implicature by defeating it, meaning by showing that it's defeasible, by showing that it can be negated without making the sentence false. But the way you did this is by tapping into the speaker's imagination. You got the speaker to help you along, because without the speaker's help, you would be confronted with the impossible task of inspecting an infinite number of situations, something you just literally cannot do. But what the speaker did for you when they helped you out, when they gave you the helping hand, when you tapped into their imagination, is they provided you with a piece of negative evidence. Okay, so here is the corresponding contradiction test. The fruit bat escaped from the lab through the window. It climbed up the windowsill and jumped out. Is that possible, or is it a contradiction? And the speaker will most likely tell you, that's perfectly fine. Sure. I mean, you know, bats can do that. And of course, this one is a lot easier than this one, because it doesn't... In this case, you're giving the speaker the scenario, so they don't have to use their imagination. Well, they have to use their imagination to find out whether this is something that's really possible, but they don't have to come up with the scenario themselves, and in that sense, they don't need to use their imagination. So, generally speaking, in my experience, tests that rely on contradiction are a lot easier, a lot more feasible to use in the field than tests that rely on the speaker imagining a particular, coming up with a particular situation in which something is or is not the case. All right, so of course, testing for entailments and testing for implicatures, in a sense, is the same thing. If you want to, so here we showed that the fruit bat flying is not an entailment. It is not an entailment because it is an implicature. So by showing that this particular inference is defeasible, we've done most of the work for showing that it's an implicature. All we have to do, all that's left to do, is just to show that it's not projected, meaning that it is speech act dependent. But if you look at it from the perspective of identifying implicatures, what you want to do directly to directly test for implicatures is to show that cancellation does not result in contradiction, or that the inference does not arise in a context that blocks it, meaning a context that contains, a discourse context that contains the negation of the proposition at issue. So, for example, you could try, despite its injury, which prevented it from flying, the fruit bat escaped from the lab through the window. So here, you're constructing a context that explicitly denied the putative implicature that the bat flew. And if that does not result in contradiction, then you know that you've identified a implicature. All right, so we've already talked about how to identify presuppositions. It basically means you have to show that the inference in question does not depend on the speech act. If you say the fruit bat escaped from the lab through the window, it may give rise to the inference that the bat flew, But if you say if you say the food bed did not escape from the lab through the window, then there is no such inference, because there's no information that the bed did anything at all. Similarly, the question, did the fruit bed escape from the lab through the window, or the conditional, if the fruit bed escaped from the lab through the window, they don't invite this inference that the fruit bed flew. Therefore, this inference is in fact speech act dependent. Therefore, you know that this is not projected. This inference is not projected. So you know that we're not dealing with a presupposition. Okay. And I just want to say, I'm surprised that I don't have that information on the slide. There is a forthcoming paper by Judith Tonhauser and colleagues, which will appear in Language shortly, I hope, which discusses in detail methods for testing for presupposition in fieldwork. Under fieldwork conditions, very creative, very resourceful study, which I highly recommend. I think this will be a big boost to people doing research on presupposition under field conditions. So now that we've hopefully got some sort of understanding of what pragmatic meaning components are and how they differ from semantic meaning components, let's put that to use in analyzing extensional data and trying to get at the underlying senses, the underlying conceptual representations in the mind of the speaker. To recap, the extension of an expression is the set of possible reference. Therefore, it's in principle observable, although the observation may not exhaust the entire extension of an expression, but it may give you at least elements of the extension. The sense, on the other hand, is the underlying concept or representation in the mind of the speaker, and as such, it's not directly observable. This is what we're trying to get at. This is what we have. This is what we start from. The question is how to get from here to there. And we're going to ignore the intention. We've talked about that already. This is an example that we already talked about yesterday briefly. It illustrates, first of all, how the primary data in field semantics and any kind of empirical semantics is observational extensional data, in this case responses by two different speakers to the Beaupère task, the topological relations picture series. Of course, these are not just the responses themselves. This is a processed form. These are Venn diagrams. So you see some of the pictures, and you see encircled areas around these pictures. These are Venn diagrams, so every encircled enclosed area represents a set of scenes that the speaker used the same preposition in response to. Recall the difference between the two speakers. This one has the super large use of the preposition in for most of the scenes in this domain, whereas this one has the same extension of N in the other speaker's usage, broken down into a number of much more specific categories, which are each labeled using specific, more semantically richer prepositions. And as I said, basically, The difference, what accounts for the difference between these responses is not a semantic difference in the mental lexicon entry for this preposition en or any of the other prepositions. Rather, it's a difference in the extent to which the speakers made use of implicatures. This speaker is only using en for those scenes where it's most informative, thereby relying on scalar implicatures to the effect that any use for which there is a more informative alternative does not apply. Alright, I already talked about this, so once again, presumably the child can figure out how to get from the extensional data she observes to the underlying representations in the mind of the speaker, the competent speaker, the adult speaker, on the basis of positive evidence alone, although we don't quite know how she does that, but the linguist cannot. The linguist needs negative evidence, and that has to do with the fact that the linguist is trying to formulate certain generalizations over the observed data that require negative data to formulate. We know that in principle what we're getting in the extensional data is the product of a number of different components. I'm going to give you a heavily simplified formula which has all sorts of problems with it, but it'll hopefully give you a basic idea. We can write sense plus x equals extension, and x comprises implicatures, presuppositions, and semantic transfer. So implicatures, presuppositions, and semantic transfer all contribute to the extension, the observable extension of an expression. And they do not necessarily form part of the sense, although semantic transfer, metaphor, and metonymy may form part of the sense. They just don't do necessarily. We'll see examples of that in a moment. So it's not true that what distinguishes sense from extension is solely utterance meaning, solely implicatures and presuppositions. In addition, semantic transfer can also play a role. These all have slightly different effects on the extension, on the observed extension. Generally, implicatures and presuppositions shrink the observed extension, meaning they make the extension appear narrower than it actually is, based on the sense the underlying semantic meaning of the expression alone. In other words, implicatures and presuppositions, in a sense, enrich the interpretation of the expression. That's in particular true of implicatures. On the other hand, semantic transfer has the opposite effect. Semantic transfer widens the observed extension. It makes the observed extension appear larger than it is on the basis of the sense alone. Alright, so examples. Stereotype implicatures. If you hear the boxer married the secretary, this is an example I like to give my students, and I like them to figure out all the possible scenarios where this can be true in terms of distribution of gender. And of course, the first thing everybody thinks is, okay, the boxer is male, the secretary is female. Then they realize, well, actually, it may also be the case that it's the other way around. The boxer may be female. That's not a stereotypical instance, but it's possible. The secretary may be male. That's also atypical, but it's possible. And of course, you can see how this depends entirely on cultural conventions. And then, depending on whether we're talking about a context in which homosexual marriage is possible, you may also have the scenario under which both are male or both are female, right? And again, you can see the role of cultural conventions. And you see how this makes the extension of this sentence, meaning the set of possible state of affairs that it describes, appears smaller, narrower than it actually is, because in reality, this sentence can possibly refer to four different scenarios: male, female, female, male, 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 and female, female. But due to stereotype implicatures, that boils down to just one interpretation that people are most likely to walk away with, which is the interpretation male boxer, female secretary. So an actual example of the same principle that we looked at this morning was in this study on Yucatec passwords and the question whether they actually entail translational motion of the figure in space. I showed you this clip where you have the plank sliding under the little ball and the cylinder here. And the question was, is it possible in this scenario to say the ball ascended to the top of the slide? And the Yucatec speakers would say no, unless you actually defeat the stereotype or block in context the stereotype implicature that it is the figure that moves. So in other words, if you look at the description, the Yucatec counterpart of the description, the ball, or rolled up the slide, let's say, if you look at the Yucatec expression of this proposition, the stereotype implicature suggests that the figure moves, and that narrows the observable extension of this description to situations in which the figure moves, thereby excluding this scenario. But once you add a little context that blocks the stereotype implicature, all of a sudden the scenario becomes acceptable, or rather the description becomes acceptable in response to this, or in reference to this scenario, and it turns out that it does in fact fall inside the extension of this description, which in turn means that the description does not entail figure motion. Oh, wait a minute. Aha. Alright, another very important kind of conversational implicature that have an impact in the data we observe in the field are manner implicatures. Now, manner and stereotype implicatures are sort of, well, they're complementary in the way they work on a sort of division of labor basis, if you know what I mean. So stereotype implicatures pick up stereotypical implications, implicatures, inferences from expressions that are simple. Manner implicatures do the opposite. Manner implicatures kick in when you're using an expression that's more complex than the simplest possible alternative, or that uses lexical expressions that are rare, infrequent, or from an unusual register, and so on and so forth. So there's something non-obvious about the expression that you're using. There's something out of the ordinary. And that suggests that the most stereotypical scenario does not apply. So a very well-known example of that is the division of labor between different causative constructions in terms of constructions that invite inferences to direct causation and constructions that invite inferences to indirect causation. It was first described, I think, by Jim McCauley in the 1970s. Imagine you have Sally stopped the car versus Sally caused the car to stop. And you ask people, assume that in one case Sally hit the brakes, but in which one? And in the other case, Sally did not, but in which one? In the other case, Sally did something more unusual. Let's say Sally actually was not in the car. She was not driving herself, but she may have stepped into the street in front of the car, causing the driver to brake. People will tell you that this is the interpretation. Sally hit the brakes is the interpretation of the simple causative verb, whereas the light verb construction, the periphrastic, the syntactic causative, gets associated with the unusual interpretation. And the unusual interpretation is the indirect causation scenario. It's unusual in the sense that it's not the most simple causal chain that you could come up with to interpret this sentence. I did a study of, my colleagues and I did a study of the semantics of causative constructions in a bunch of different languages using video clips. And what we found was that, for example, whenever there was a causal chain that showed a spatial gap or a certain lapse of time between cause and effect. So imagine you see somebody hit a plate with a hammer, but instead of the plate going to pieces immediately, that only happens after a moment passes by, right? Whenever that kind of thing happened, the Yucatec speakers would go to a periphrastic causative, something like cause to stop, rather than to use a simple causative verb. We get very similar effects in the cut and break study, which I talked about this morning. We found that speakers from a number of languages that have various kinds of complex predicates, such as Lao and Sranan, both of which have serial verb constructions, and Yucatec Maya, which has verb-verb compounds, which is sort of the polysynthetic language's equivalent of serial verb constructions, or German, my native language, which has verb-particle constructions. All of these languages, as soon as you show them a kind of scenario that's unusual in terms of the combination of the object that's being acted on and the instrument that's used to act on them, you get a complex predicate. So, for example, this clip which I showed you this morning, which involves a guy with, with a hammer, severing a piece of cloth with a mallet, then you get complex responses, complex predicates. One of the German speakers said something like, "Er zerhämmerte Omas Kleid." He zerhammered Grandma's dress. And zerhämmern is not a verb that you're going to find in any dictionary of German. The speaker made that up on the fly. But it illustrates the need to use a complex predicate when you're encountering a non-stereotypical scenario. Similarly here, a Yucatec speaker, in response to the same clip, produced a verb-verb compound. He said he rip-hit the piece of cloth with the hammer, meaning he hit it, causing it to rip, or rather, actually, what this construction really means after a lot of semantic analysis is he hit it in a manner such as to rip it. But that's a secondary issue. So the point is, you get a distribution, division of labor, where the more complex predicates are used to pick up the less typical, the unusual combinations of instruments and themes, and you get simple causative verbs to take care of business as usual, dealing with the stereotypical instrument theme combinations. And again, these are extensions that are narrower than the semantics of the particular verbs and verb compounds and so on and so forth actually allows for, due to the influence of manner implicatures. Scalar implicatures, that's the preemption effect. We already talked about that. Floyd ate some of the cookies, suggests he didn't eat all of the cookies, but does not entail that. Sally started writing a book on semantics, implicates she didn't finish the book. I want to give you a quick example of how that mattered in my fieldwork. It turned up in an analysis of the demonstrative system of Yucatec. So Yucatec, strictly speaking, doesn't have demonstratives of the kind that we know from languages such as English. Instead, it has clause final particles that are triggered by the determiner, and there is a particle which is used for scenes proximal to the speaker, and then there is a particle or which is used for scenes that are distal to the speaker. Now, the question was, is it actually the case that semantically means proximity and or means distance from the speaker, from the speech situation? And it turned out, first of all, that was never particularly likely because the particle or can not only be used for distal scenes, but it can also be used for reference to objects that were mentioned before in discourse, meaning it's not just used deictically, exophorically, with respect to the speech situation, picking up a referent in the speech situation, that it can also be used anaphorically. which the particle A cannot. So my hypothesis was that, as a matter of fact, A is positively semantically specified for exophoric reference to objects that are in the proximity of the speaker, in the speech situation, whereas O has a much more general meaning. It's a general indexical. It can be used exophorically or anaphorically, and in fact in other ways as well. But it gets associated with the distal domain simply by preemption, because A is the more semantically specific and therefore more informative partner in this opposition. And of course, that suggests that it is in fact possible to use or for the items that are in the speaker's zone of proximity as well. And I was able to show that that's the case. Although, strictly speaking, you cannot use or for things that are on the body of the speaker, which is a very interesting phenomenon. And it's not easy to explain. Okay. Finally, presuppositions. Quick example for how presuppositions mattered in my field work. So, I mentioned earlier that in my dissertation I tried to show that Yucatec is a tense. Well, I think I mentioned it, that Yucatec is a tenseless language, meaning there's no tense marking in this language. Now, Yucatec has a very rich aspect mood marking system, which I described in detail, and that this system also includes what looks like markers of metrical tense. So metrical tense markers are tenses that are restricted, for example, to events that happened earlier on the day of utterance, or to events that happened before, but on the day before the day of utterance, or to events that happened long ago, or in the speaking in the future, events that happened that the speaker predicts will happen a long time from now, from the moment of utterance. Obviously, if that's what these things are, metrical tenses are tenses, therefore they would contradict my claim that Yucatec is a tenseless language. But I was able to show that while these expressions, such as this recent past marker, Sam, which generally speaking is used for events that happened earlier on the day of utterance, these guys semantically only talk about distance from a reference point, but not actually about the temporal relation between the time of the event and the reference point. That relation is actually presupposed rather than coded. It's not part of the semantics of this expression. And how do you show that it's presupposed? Suppose you negate a sentence in which the marker in question occurs, then of course, due to the speech act independence of presupposition, we expect that the presupposition remains intact, and that is exactly what we observe. So if I say the combi, I have to explain this, the combi is mainstream Mexicans, for want of a better expression, would call a colectivo. It's a collective taxi. In this Yucatecan village, in this Mayan village where I've been working for a long time, people call that a combi. If I say Sam sunak le combio, that means the combi returned a while ago, earlier on the day of utterance. Now, if I say Masam sunak le combio, I can continue this saying in Wakatsok media ora. I think it was maybe half an hour ago. But I cannot, it would be infelicitous to continue to men masunaki because it hasn't yet returned. So the fact that the Combe's return precedes the reference time, which in this case is the moment of utterance, is not actually a semantic property of this construction, it's a presupposition. Which again has the effect that the presupposition makes the extension of these morphemes appear more narrow than they are based on the semantic properties of the markers alone. And lastly, semantic transfer, very briefly, semantic transfer, metaphor and metonymy, of course, may be a part of the sense, the mental lexicon entry of the expression itself. That's the case if it's conventionalized, but it may also be something that speakers create on the fly. Such as in the case of the famous Nunberg metonyms, as in the ham sandwich is sitting at table 20, where the speaker is supposed to be a waitress talking to another waitress, and what she means by ham sandwich is not actually the sandwich, but rather the person who ordered it. Right? So that's a metonymic reference from the sandwich to the person who ordered it, the kind of semantic transfer. But clearly this is not a conventional meaning of the noun, the compound ham sandwich in English. It's something that the speaker here does on the fly for this particular utterance. And this can happen with metaphor as well, and that's something I've been studying as part of a study of meronymy, meaning expressions for object parts, something that is very prominent in Mesoamerican languages and has an important influence, apparently, on strategies of spatial reference in Mesoamerican languages, the use of these object part terms. Now, in order to study these kinds of expressions some more, we had a set of novel objects made for us, which are objects of a shape that's unfamiliar to both speakers of Mesoamerican languages and to other people from outside that area as well. So they don't have any conventional interpretation. And the question was, would people be able to refer to the parts of these objects without first establishing some sort of overall interpretation and also an orientation of the object? Because there are some proposals in the literature for some of these systems, and we'll talk about that some more in a later lecture, that should be possible. So that's what we wanted to test. And what I found for Yucatec in particular was that it depends a little bit on what parts we're talking about. There's a big difference between surface parts and volume parts. Or strictly speaking, surface parts and parts for edges or extreme points on the one hand, and volume parts on the other. Because when it came to volume parts, generally speaking, the identification did rely on people establishing an interpretation of the overall object. And it also was the case that very frequently similes and hedges would accompany the use of terms for volume parts. So they would, for example, say the little ball that is as if it had big anpe yoka, as if it had four legs. So we're not actually saying that the parts of this object can be readily referred to as legs in a way that is going to be obvious to the interlocutor, to other speakers of this language. Rather, we're going to have to explicitly mark the fact that we're treating these as legs. So this is very clear, overtly metaphor. It's overtly marking semantic transfer. Or, for example, umien balilo, demen okobo. It's little things that are sort of like legs. And here the speaker said explicitly, let's call that its arms. Let's call those things its arms. So this was in a referential communication task where the people again had a screen between them, and their goal was to instruct each other to put little bits of Play-Dohs onto these different parts. And in order to do that, they had to refer successfully, identify verbally these parts. So this is what they had to do when it came to volume parts, whereas when it came to surface parts, so terms such as back and front, top and bottom, and so on and so forth, they would never ever use any similes or hedges. So it turns out that the surface and edge parts have more general, more abstract geometric meanings, which allow the speakers to apply them to any arbitrary object regardless of interpretation, whereas the volume parts are labeled on the basis of body part metaphors, and these body part metaphors are to some extent conventionalized. And so you notice that the effect of this kind of semantic transfer really is the inverse of the effect of the pragmatic meaning components. The pragmatic meaning components make the extension appear narrower than it is on the basis of the semantic of the expression alone, whereas semantic transfer does the opposite by adding elements such as the parts of these novel objects to the extension that actually don't fall under the extension purely on the sense as a static concept alone. All right, we don't have the time to talk about diagnostics in lexical semantics. I will just tell you what's on the slides and otherwise skip over this. Basically, and this is where I was stumbling in the beginning of the lecture, where it said we need negative evidence not just to get from extension to intension or to sense, but also we need negative evidence to establish semantic properties of the sense. So what I was thinking about there is properties such as hyponymy, antonymy, and so on and so forth, lexical semantic relations which apply at the sense level and which can only be indirectly inferred on the basis of extensional data alone. So generally what you need in order to do this are diagnostics, and the point I'm trying to make in this section of the lecture, which I can't go through in detail, is that those diagnostics have a number of principal sources of evidence they tap into. Mostly those are intuitions for referential satisfaction, if you will, or contradiction, intuitions for semantic interpretability versus anomaly, intuitions for pragmatic felicitousness, and also intuitions for the prototypicality of a particular referent as opposed to the marginal status of a possible referent. And then I simply give you a number of examples, such as ambiguity tests, for example, tests for lexical ambiguity, meaning polysemy or homonymy, would involve either tests based on interpretability or anomaly, such as the classic Zucma test. For example, John and his driver's license expired last Thursday. That has a funny effect because you're trying to activate two different senses at the same time. More properly speaking, you actually, because of this this coordination ellipsis construction here, you're actually tapping into the two different senses for the same referent, and that leads to a clash, and that has this kind of humorous effect. So that would be an example of an anomaly-based ambiguity test, whereas the test of discrete deniability of senses is one that relies on intuitions for contradiction versus referential satisfaction, or intuitions for truth conditions or attainments. Let's say, if you say, is there a slide missing here? No, I just didn't exemplify this. So if you have, we did see this before, I think during the very first lecture, if you have something like that's not a cow, that's a bull, right? You can say this because cow has two different senses in English. One is bovine, the other is female bovine. Because these are discrete senses, it's possible to deny the application of one to the referent of that while simultaneously asserting the application of the other. That otherwise ought to lead to contradiction. So compare... No, actually, that's not it. What was my example? Let me see. So according to Alan Crewe's classic textbook in lexical semantics, whereas this one's fine, at least in his Scottish dialect of English, this one's not, suggesting that the interpretation equine versus male equine of the noun horse do not constitute polysemy. Therefore, you get a contradiction here. Whereas apparently the senses bovine and female bovine do constitute a case of polysemy of the noun cow. So this would be an example of two different tests for ambiguity. One that's based on intuitions or knowledge of contradictions or referential satisfaction, the other one that's based on intuitions for interpretability versus anomaly. And the point I was making, so I was going, or I am going over a number of different semantic, lexical semantic relations, such as hyponymy, meronymy, taxonymy, and I'm showing that for all of these, there are diagnostics that are based on either of these different sources of evidence. So you can typically go either way. Okay, now, summary, and we really have to finish. So the empirical basis of field semantics is inferring senses from observed extensions, since semanticists aren't mind readers. To do this, semanticists require negative evidence, meaning evidence that goes beyond the observed extension and talks to what can be in it or what cannot be in it. And to achieve this, semanticists manipulate real or imagined situations and observe how this affects native speakers' intuitions about the applicability of certain expressions in reference to these situations. The process of isolating senses from extensions involves the distinction between semantic and pragmatic meaning components and that between literal and transferred meanings. Observed extensions are narrowed by pragmatic enrichment but widened by semantic transfer, and the core phenomena of semantics and pragmatics, such as entailment, contradiction, ambiguity, anomaly, implicature, presupposition, and speech act meaning, can be explored in the field directly or indirectly on the basis of native speaker intuitions for conditions of successful reference and or truth conditions, which is not to say that these phenomena can be captured exhaustively in referential terms. And diagnostics of lexical semantic relations are always based on intuitions for either contradictions or anomaly. Well, I should say Alan Cruz mentions a possible third type of evidence which has a much more reduced currency, but I'm a little bit dubious about that. It's very briefly intuitions for analogies of semantic relations across pairs or triplets, etc., of lexical items. All right, and that wraps it up. So tomorrow, I think we are leaving field semantics behind and we're going to start talking about semantic typology, but first we'll talk a little bit about the precursor of semantic typology in anthropological research, linguistic anthropology in particular, and that's ethnosemantics. So that will be the topic for the morning lecture. Semantic typology will be the topic for the afternoon lecture. Thank you.